turning to Erin, who whispered instructions to a sentry. The man ran off to warn the ostler. "We have a fine feast for you," said the Duke. "It will be ready within the hour, and there are rooms prepared in the North Tower." The knight dismounted. "Where is the stable?" "Erin," said the Duke, biting back his anger, "show the king's messenger to the stable. I will see you both in the great hall." As the Duke departed, Erin approached the knight. "Was your journey arduous?" "The stable, if you please." "Certainly. Follow me." Erin led the knight across the square into the stable yard, where the other horses were being led away. As the stranger entered the yard leading the stallion, several horses began to whinny and rear. Their handlers fought to control them, but the knight's horse remained motionless, its head still. "He's well trained," said Erin. The red knight did not reply but walked past Erin, leading his horse. Erin reached up to pat the beast's back, but his hand recoiled as it touched the flesh of the creature's flank. It was cold as ice. Inside the stable, the knight unsaddled the stallion and led him into a stall. The horse stood silently, ignoring the feed box.
There are blankets close by. I'll have them fetched," said Erin.
"There is no need."
"I beg to differ, Sir Knight. The horse is cold."
The red knight swung on Erin. "Do not touch him again. I do not like to see others place their hands upon what is mine."
As you please," said Erin. "What is your name?"
"I am the king's messenger. You, I take it, are Erin, the lord of the feast."
"I am."
"Show me to my rooms, and have a woman brought to me. A young woman."
With respect, Sir Knight, I am not a procurer of women. There are many inns in Macther, and many women who sell their services. I would suggest you attend to the Duke and then make your way there after the feast of welcome."
The knight stood silently for a moment. "You are quite right, Erin," he said at last. "I'm tired after my journey, and my manners are lacking."
"Think nothing of it, sir. Let me show you to your rooms," replied Erin coolly.
In the main room a fire blazed, and a hip bath had been filled with warmed, scented water. Erin left the knight to prepare himself and rejoin the Duke in the great hall.
"What a humorless, mannerless dolt," stormed the Duke. "Is the king trying to insult me, do you think?"
"I would think not, my lord. The king has always held you in high esteem, and quite rightly. Perhaps the knight is tired. He did apologize to me at the stable."
"Yes, and that's another matter. His horse is to be stabled alone. Is this a prince among horses?"
"It is a strange beast, my lord. When the other horses were being led away, they seemed terrified of it. I think that is what he was thinking of."
"Well, his attitude will not do, Erin. I'm of a mind to write to the king about him."
"Might I suggest, respectfully, that you suspend judgment until we have seen him again? The king obviously favors and trusts him."
"Wise words, Erin. But he would do well to show good manners this time."
"I'm sure that he will, my lord."
As he spoke, the Crimson Knight came into view at the top of the staircase. He was still in full armor, but had removed his helm. His face was ivory pale and extraordinarily beautiful, his hair white and cropped close to his skull. He seemed in his early 20s. Erin moved forward, greeting him with a smile. Seen closer, he looked older, perhaps 30, perhaps more. The knight bowed. His eyes were dark and bloodshot, and he seemed weary beyond words.
"Are you well, sir?"
Erin asked.
"Well enough, Lord Erin.
Your armor will wear you down. Tonight is a time for feasting and dancing.
I do not dance. I am here to inspect the duchy on behalf of the king. Dancing I leave to others. But do not concern yourself about my armor. It never leaves me. That is part of an oath I have sworn.
I see, said Erin. Tell me your name, sir, so that we may introduce you.
The knight hesitated for a moment, then responded with a swift, almost shy smile. My name is Cabra. Erin, resplendent in hose and doublet of blue silk, shot with silver, sat at the Duke's left hand during the feast of welcome, the Red Knight taking his place on the Duke's right. There were some 30 of the Duke's retainers present at the great square table, nobles all, from minor gentlemen of the duchy to knights of the order. Erin had surpassed himself, and the food, as all agreed, was exquisite. Giant mushrooms, filled with minced beef and coated with northern duchy cheese, 10 roast swans, honeyed ham, spiced beef, and cakes of surpassing sweetness. But Erin noticed that the knight scarcely touched his food, and asked for water to replace the wine he was served. The Duke grew more ill at ease during the feast and was unable to draw his guest into any lengthy conversation. Finally, he gave up altogether and turned his attention to Erin.
Splendidly organized, fit for a king, said the Duke, wiping sweat from his brow with a scented handkerchief.
I can assure you that the king's feast will be even finer, my lord. In the spring there will be many other delights which, sadly, the autumn denies us. As the slaves cleared away the dishes, Erin clapped his hands and rose. The guests fell silent.
Friends, the Duke hopes you have enjoyed the meal, and now asks that you make your way to the narrow hall where musicians are waiting for the dances to begin.
As the guests filed away, a flute began to play in the narrow hall, joined by a harp. The sound was lilting and light, and the Duke's mood changed.
By heavens, Erin, is that Corius playing?
It is, my lord. I took the liberty of requesting his presence for the evening.
The man charges a fortune.
I hope you will accept his performance as a gift, sir. The Duke bowed his head.
You have outdone yourself. Well done.
Turning to the Red Knight, he said,
I overheard you tell Erin you did not dance. Would you prefer to retire?
I will watch the dancing, said the knight, rising.
Erin followed him into the hall, where many couples were now engaged in the dance of the winter sun. The music was merry, and Erin saw Dianu dancing with the young knight Goan. Her dark hair was bound with silver thread, and she wore a dress of shimmering white silk.
I think, said the knight, that you would prefer to dance rather than to stand with such a somber guest.
The ghost of a smile touched his lips as he spoke. Erin grinned.
That is the woman I hope to marry.
Then lead her to the music, sir.
Erin needed no second invitation. Moving smoothly across the hall to the dancers, he tapped Goan on the shoulder.
Goan, my dear fellow, would you introduce the king's messenger to the other guests?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Erin took Dianu's arm and led her into the dance. When the music stopped, he took her to the rear of the hall, where slaves were stationed carrying silver trays on which were goblets of light white wine. Erin took one and passed it to his companion.
You are looking exceedingly beautiful this evening, he told her.
I only came because you asked me, said Dianu. What do you know of that strange young man with the white hair?
His name is Cabra.
I know nothing of him, save that he is the king's messenger.
His face is very sad, These are sad times, he whispered. Come, let us seek some air.
They left unnoticed through a side door and mounted the steps to a small chamber, where Erin had ordered a fire lit. The room was warm, the window open. Dianu wandered to it, staring out over the town of Macther and its twinkling lights. I'm leaving for Sitheron, she said.
Leaving? But why?
She turned suddenly.
Oh, Erin, don't be such a fool. The king is murdering nomads. The kingdom is falling ever more deeply in debt. Every day there are stories of unrest, of murder and robbery. Where will it end?
He moved to her and led her from the window. Best not to speak of such things where you can be overheard, he said, keeping his voice low. But Firbolg is a long way away, and in Macther we do not suffer.
We do not suffer, but there are food shortages in the countryside. Winter is not yet here. It's all right for the nobility, with its roast swans, but swans will not feed a nation, Erin.
I'd hoped we could be married at midwinter, he said. Are you saying the marriage will not take place? She took his hand and kissed it.
Of course I'm not saying that. I love you. But we could be married in Sitheron.
Erin shook his head.
You cannot leave without the king's blessing, he said, and he will not give it. The Duke was telling me that 7 noble families have secretly left the realm, taking their riches with them. They have been branded traitors and their lands forfeited. This is your home, Dianu. Do you want to live the rest of your life in a foreign land, hated, despised by your countrymen? You do not see as I see, she answered sadly. There is evil here, Erin. Real terrible evil, waiting to engulf all of us. The king is mad and surrounded by madmen. Did the death of Kester not trouble you? A fine man, a noble man, put to death for having a nomad grandmother. Sweet heaven, Erin, why do you not see?
Pulling her to him, he kissed her face. I do see, he told her. These are dangerous times, but they will pass. We can ride out the storm. She pushed him from her.
It is not enough to ride out the storm. I'm leaving here in 2 days. All the arrangements are made. My father, rest his soul, had many contacts in Sitheron, and I have transferred funds through the merchant Cartain. All that is left here is the palace, and I can live without that.
All that is left here? He said softly.
You will leave me here, Dianu? And I cannot leave.
For a long moment she looked into his eyes, saying nothing.
It is your choice, she said at last.
I know that, he answered, backing away. May fortune follow you. He turned swiftly, opened the door and made his way to the narrow hall. The music was faster now, punctuated by the laughter of the dancers as they swept into the furious pace of the dance of the storm. Unnoticed, Erin passed through the double doors and out into the night. Chapter 5 Arion ran smoothly up the game trail, her stride long, her footing sure. Every evening the deer travelled this trail, but these she never hunted, for they were too close to the settlement. As her father had warned her during her training, when you are fit and strong, hunt far from home. You never know when disaster may strike, a sudden blizzard or a lame leg, and you may come to need the meat you allow to live. But hunt within sight of the settlement, and you will drive the game far from you. He had been a good man and a better father, until the wasting disease hit him.
It had been hard watching his strength melt from his bones, despite all his wife's skills. As the end drew near, Arion's mother prepared him a goblet of wine mixed with foxglove. He had died peacefully, and the two women had wept together beside his corpse. Arion's mind dwelt on that image as she ran, and she did not see the slender wire taut across her path. Hitting it with her lead leg, she tumbled to the trail, and instantly three men raced from the trees. Dropping her bow, Arion reached for her hunting knife, but a diving body struck the air from her lungs, and coarse hands held her down.
"Well now," said the man sitting astride her and pressing a grimy hand to her breast. "What have we here?"
She felt hands tearing at her trews and kicked out. The man above her slapped her viciously across the cheek.
"What shoe for days we have?"
he said, casually hitting her with his other hand.
"Watched you and wanted you. Beg, will you? Beg Grianne to spare you."
Arching her neck, she spat in Grianne's face. Another casual blow snapped her head back to the ground. He ripped open her shirt and gazed down at her body. His face was round and brutal, his mouth open, showing blackened teeth.
"You pack of whore sons!"
came a voice, and the man above Arion stiffened and turned. Standing at the center of the trail was a hooded man in a black cloak. The sun was behind him, and his face was hidden. Two of the men pulled knives from their belts, and Grianne also drew a knife, but remained kneeling on the stunned girl. The hooded man threw his cloak back over his shoulders. His right arm ended at the wrist, the stump covered by a black leather cap laced along his arm, and he carried no weapons. Grianne smiled and stood.
"You picked the wrong time and the wrong place, cripple," he said, advancing. "You are dead. Food for maggots."
Grianne's two companions eased out to the newcomer's left and right. But he did not move back. Instead, he stepped forward. The attacker to his left leapt for him with knife arm extended. The cripple swayed back and the knife flashed by him. At the same moment, his elbow hammered into the attacker's throat and he staggered, his face turning blue. Then he slumped, dying to his knees, his fingers scrabbling at his throat. As the second knife man charged in, the hooded man spun on his heel and leapt, his booted foot thundering into the man's jaw. The knife man's neck cracked like a dry stick. The hooded man landed lightly and turned back to Grianne.
"You won't take me with your fancy tricks," Grianne snarled. "No, I won't," said the man softly.
Grianne stepped forward. Arion's knife entered his lower back, driving up through his lungs and into his heart. A strangled cry escaped him as he fell face down in the earth. Arion found her trews and pulled them on. The laces were cut, but she roughly fastened them. When she looked back, the stranger was sitting on a tree trunk with his face turned from her. Gathering her bow, she moved to him.
"My thanks for your gallantry."
He pushed back his hood, and she saw a square face and deep brown eyes. He was not handsome, but he radiated strength. He smiled and became handsome.
"It was not gallant, it was merely necessary. Are you hurt?"
"Only my pride. I should have seen their trap."
"It is only from such mistakes that we learn. How are you called?"
"I am Arion."
He nodded and rose. He was a head taller than Arion, which made him tall indeed.
"Is your home close by?" he asked.
"About an hour to the west."
"May I escort you there?"
"There is no need," she told him, reddening.
"No offense was intended, Arion.
It was just that I'm hungry, and a meal would not be unpleasant."
You have not told me your name.
I am Elodan.
She looked into his dark eyes and kept the pity from her own.
The king's champion.
Once upon a time. Shall we go?
You really should not walk in the forest without weapons. It is not safe, she said.
No, I will be more careful, he told her with a wry smile. She looked back at the bodies and grinned.
There are some larger bands of wolf's heads, and despite your skill, you are no match for a bowman.
Indeed, I am not.
Together they set off down the trail, Arion leading. After a while, she looked back at him.
You are very quiet, she said.
I was thinking.
What about?
Are you married? He asked.
No, why do you ask?
Merely to make conversation. How old are you?
17. And you?
Older than time, he chuckled. At least it feels like it sometimes.
You don't look more than 30.
As I said, older than time. To a 17-year-old.
Waking with a sore head and a stomach that seemed to be on wheels, Erin groaned and rolled to his side. The empty flagon of wine lay in pieces where he had hurled it at dawn. He opened his eyes slowly and groaned again as he remembered the events of the previous evening. Dianu was going away. He could not quite believe it, yet he knew her well enough to realize that she meant what she said. He decided to ride to her palace later in the afternoon. His new manservant, Boren, entered silently.
"Your bath is ready, my lord," he said.
"For pity's sake, don't shout," Erin told him.
"I hear it was a good feast, sir."
Erin looked up at the balding servant, taking in his tanned, healthy face and his sickeningly clear eyes.
"I feel that if I blink too quickly, I will bleed to death," he said.
"The bath will revive you, my lord, and the council meets in an hour."
Erin flopped back on his pillows and pulled the blankets over his head. Boren sighed, cleared away the broken flagon, opened the velvet curtains and left the room. Alone once more, Erin sat up. The Council of Nobles was a deadly dull affair, and usually no more than 3 or 4 of them turned up for the meeting. But today was different. Today the Red Knight, Kerbra, would be present, along with the Lord Seer, Okessa. Everyone would be there, vying to show their loyalty to the king.
"A pox on it!" said Erin, sliding from the bed and walking through to the outer room in his steaming bath. The water was rose-scented, which Erin had never liked, and Ubadai had never forgotten that. But Boren was new and had yet to learn his master's tastes. Erin walked down the marble steps and splashed into the bath. After a few minutes, Boren entered with his robe and the nobleman stepped into it.
"How do my eyes look?"
he asked the servant. Boren peered at him.
"A bloodshot, sir. In fact, you do not look well. You should see them from this side. What shall I wear?"
"After the meeting, the Duke has arranged a hunt, so I've laid out your riding outfit."
"The black leather with silver trim?"
No, sir, the red."
"Make it the black. I'll leave the red to the Duke's guest."
"Yes, sir.
Might I suggest some breakfast, sir?"
"No,"
said Erin, shuddering as his mobile stomach heaved.
"You may be glad of it while bouncing up and down on a horse."
"Bouncing? One doesn't bounce, Boren. One rides."
"Indeed, my lord. Perhaps a little dry bread?"
Erin nodded and walked through to his bedroom, waiting while Boren fetched his clothes. The trews were fashionably cut from soft black leather, ending at the calf,
Over these, Erin pulled a pair of knee-length black boots. His tunic was of wool, black and unadorned, while his riding coat was of black leather, double-shouldered and trimmed with silver thread.
"You will need a cloak, sir. There is a vicious wind."
"I'll take the black one, with the sheepskin lining and the hood."
"It needs to be oiled, sir. I will have it ready after the meeting."
After breaking his fast with bread and a little cheese, Erin walked across the courtyard to the main hall. Some members of the council were already inside, waiting to be summoned through to the inner chambers.
"Good morning, Lord Erin,"
said a portly man dressed in riding clothes of green velvet. Sweat shone on his brow.
"It is pleasant to see you, Lord Porteron. I missed you at the feast."
"Yes, yes, I had work to attend to. I'm told it was a fine affair."
"Yes," agreed Erin, turning to greet a newcomer. "Lord Delanne, good morning. You look wonderfully refreshed considering your exertions on the dance floor." The slim young man in the brown tunic grinned.
"Youth, my dear Erin, my, my, you do look a little frail."
"I guarantee that I look better than I feel. You know Lord Porteron?" "Of course. How are you, sir?"
"I am well, very well. Couldn't be better."
During the next few minutes, the other lords and knights made their entrance. Last to arrive was the Lord Seer, dressed in robes of white. Erin greeted them all and sent a message to the Duke that the council was assembled. As always, the Duke kept them waiting the obligatory 10 minutes. Then they filed into the inner chamber, where a long table was set with 6 chairs on either side and 2 at the head. The Duke was sitting talking to Cabra. As the nobles entered, the Duke waved them to their seats, and Erin strode the length of the table to sit alongside Cabra. The man seemed greatly refreshed. His eyes were clear, and there was colour in his pale cheeks.
"I see that you slept well, Sir Cabra," said Erin.
"I am well rested. Thank you for your concern."
The business of the day proceeded much as always. Tax gathering was discussed, and the greater incidences of robbery close to the forest. There was talk from Porteron of a problem with runaway slaves in the west, and a shortage of skilled workers for the fields. It was agreed to ship 40 slaves to his estate.
"What is causing the shortage?" asked Erin.
Porteron blinked and rubbed at his sweating face with a handkerchief.
"It is not a great problem, Lord Erin."
"I take your word for that, of course, but is it disease?"
"Oh, no, no. Naturally, we have followed to the letter the decree of our dear and revered monarch. But we have had a large number of resident nomads. They have been sent to Gar Aden, and temporarily, you understand, we are short of workers."
"I see. Thank you."
"We expected short-term problems of this nature," said Orkessa smoothly. "But the land and its nobles can only benefit from the removal of these tainted souls."
All around the table, heads nodded in agreement.
"You have a further point to make?" Orkessa asked.
Erin shook his head.
No, my lord seer. I understand that in Macther there is now a shortage of bread, since the local baker was dispossessed."
"The shortage arose, Lord Erin, because the filthy nomad burned down his own premises. He should have been hung."
"May I say a word, gentlemen?" said Cabra, rising. "I know, as does the king, that the removal of the nomad vermin is bound to cause immediate hardship in many areas. But the ultimate goal is a worthy one. A crusade, if you will. Less than 30 years ago, the lords of this kingdom ruled the entire continent. For 200 years, we brought laws, education, civilization to nations of barbarians. But we allowed ourselves to become weak, tainted with the blood of lesser peoples, and now we rule only the land of the 9 duchies. Our strength, both physical and spiritual, has been polluted. A great cleansing is needed. Until this year, the economy of the realm has been largely in the hands of the merchant class, who are predominantly nomad. The king was becoming powerless in his own land. Now the treasury is ruled by the king, and his wisdom is beyond question. The future, gentlemen, stands and beckons. When the realm is rid of all impurity, we shall rise again and become preeminent among nations.
Cabra sat down to stunned silence, which was immediately broken as the Duke applauded, followed by the entire council. Erin clapped hands with the rest, but less enthusiastically. Words and phrases flashed in his mind. Lesser peoples, vermin, impurity, taint.
"Thank you, Sir Cabra," said Orkessa. "Your stirring words have brought us to the most delicate of matters. As you will know, the king has decreed that all of nomad blood are to be sent to Garadan. I have, on the Duke's insistence, begun examinations of all families with known nomad connections. It seems we have two noble families in Macther with tainted blood."
Erin's eyes flickered around the table. Lord Porteron's face was chalk-white.
"Sadly, our duty to the king necessitates that these also be sent to Garadan," Orkessa continued. "I have always been loyal," said Porteron, rising. "My family has fought in three wars for the king and the crown."
"Your loyalty is not in question, sir," said Orkessa with a thin smile. "And I'm sure the king will arrange your speedy return to us."
"This is outrageous. Insane." "Be so kind, Porteron," said the Duke, "as to wait outside. There are men waiting there who will take you to your quarters."
"Sir Cabra," shouted Porteron, "surely the king cannot mean to destroy the noble families. The nomad line in my house goes back to my great-grandfather."
The Red Knight rose, his eyes cold. "Already you have shown the worth of your nomad blood. A direct order from your duke to leave has been disobeyed. Moreover, you have willingly sent to Garadan people from your district who have even more tenuous blood links than your own. Had your true blood been in the ascendancy, you would have come to the duke and confessed. Now get out of my sight." Porteron staggered back as if struck and stumbled from the room. Erin had guessed that Porteron was out of favor when he had been instructed not to invite him to the feast. But this...
"You mentioned two noble families, Lord Orkessa," said the young Lord Delan. "It is no one present, sir," said Orkessa. "I refer to the Lady Dianu, whose mother was of nomad extraction."
Erin felt his heart hammer in his chest, and his hands began to tremble.
"The Lady Dianu's mother died in childbirth," said Erin. "She was from Cithaeron, and there is no record of any nomad involvement in her bloodline."
"Sadly, that is not the case," said Orkessa, unable to keep a triumphant grin from his thin lips. "She was the daughter of a man named Kial Orde, who was born on the eastern steppes into a nomad tribe called the Wolves. There is no doubting her tainted line. She has been summoned to Macther and will be sent to Garadan."
Erin bit back any further argument. "My congratulations, Lord Seer. As ever, you have been meticulous in your endeavours."
"Meticulous enough, Lord Erin, to have discovered that you plan to marry this woman. Thankfully, you are now spared the prospect of coupling with a nomad whore."
The words were sent like arrows, but Erin had been expecting something of the like.
"Indeed, my lord, I can hardly think of the words to thank you."
Orkessa's disappointment was obvious,
and it brought a taunting grin from Erin, who leaned forward, holding the seer's gaze.
"Happily, sir," said Erin, "there is no doubt as to your bloodline. Your mother was a fine gabbelin of good stock, who plied a trade among the sailors near the docks at Firbolg. I'm confident. They were all good gabbelin sailors, and there was not a nomad among them."
"How dare you?"
stormed Okessa, surging to his feet.
"How dare I? How dare the son of a common prostitute abuse the name of a noble lady of this realm?" "I take it, Erin, that you will champion her. You will demand trial by combat," Okessa hissed.
Erin froze as the words hammered home. All he had been taught as a knight and the son of an earl screamed at him to accept the challenge in the name of chivalry. But all that he had learned as a man warned him to beware. He was no swordsman, and he knew what had happened to the champion Elladan. He took a deep breath. "I will consider that option," he said, aware that all eyes were upon him. He transferred his gaze to the table and fought to quell the anger within.
"You will consider the option," sneered Okessa. "How gallant of you!"
"That is enough," snapped the Duke. "The Lord Erin has every right to take time on this issue. We were, all fond of the Lady Dianu. But if her blood is tainted, then it is right that she travel to Gar-Aden. The King's word is law. We all accept that. Now let us move on."
Erin sat in a daze throughout the rest of the meeting, images racing through his mind. Dianu had told him that evil was rampant in the land, and now she would pay, perhaps with her life. He thought of her being brought to Macthe, derided and alone, to endure the sneers of serpents like Okessa. And what would she find in Gar-Aden? Stripped of wealth and privilege, she would be forced to live in a desert hut, making a living as best she could among other nomads. But what skills did she have that could make her life bearable? None, save her beauty. They might just as well kill her, he realized. When she was brought to Macthe, he would have to avoid seeing her. He would not be able to meet her eyes. And when they took her away, he would have to live every day of his life in the knowledge that he had done nothing to save the woman he loved. Love. At the thought of the word and the emotions it conveyed, his throat swelled. He swallowed hard. Yes, he loved Dianu. He always had, ever since they were children together. Could he bear to live, knowing he had done nothing to aid her? In that moment he knew he did not have the courage to turn away from her. He blinked and stared around the table. The meeting was obviously over and all eyes were on him as his voice came surprisingly clear and strong.
"My sword will speak for the Lady Dianu," he declared.
Okessa smiled as he sank back in his chair and switched his gaze to the stunned Duke.
"My lord, you must name someone to champion the king's cause." "Retract, Erin," whispered the Duke. "This is madness."
"I cannot."
"I think you should," said Kerbera softly, "for I must champion the king's cause, and that will mean us facing one another." Erin shrugged.
"What will be, will be."
"I hope," said Kerbera, "that you are a fine swordsman, but think on this. I am the man who cut the hand from Elladan, and he was the best I ever fought."
A storm broke over the forest as Ruad, Gwydion, and the three magic hounds reached the shelter of the trees. Ruad led the way into the thickest of the woods, seeking a haven from the driving rain. Mortally tired,
Gwydion slipped on a muddy slope and fell heavily. Ruad walked back to help him to his feet. Calling one of the golden hounds, Ruad lifted Gwydion to its back.
"Such is the fate of old men," said Gwydion with a weak smile, "to be mounted on a dog."
Ruad chuckled. "At least it is a magic dog."
"Have you been here before, Ruad?"
2 years ago, I came looking for herbs. There is an old cabin about a mile further along the trail. It was uninhabited then.
Now?"
He shrugged.
"This is a gloomy place," said Gwydion.
"It will look better by sunlight, I promise you." They continued on the trail and Gwydion found his mount not entirely to his liking. The metal back made a poor seat, the plates grinding and pinching the skin of his thighs, but it was a great deal less arduous than walking. Ruad's recollection of the distance was faulty, and it was 2 hours and almost midnight before they came to the cabin. It was no longer empty and no longer solitary. 4 other homes had been built close by.
"I hope we will be welcome," said Gwydion.
Ruad did not reply. Warm golden light showed through the gap in the shutters of the window as he rapped his fist against the door. It was opened by a young man, carrying a broad-bladed knife.
"What do you want?"
asked the man. Then he saw the golden hounds, his mouth gaped and he stepped back, the knife forgotten.
"A wizard!"
he shouted to someone behind him. Ruad moved swiftly into the house.
"Indeed I am,"
he said, forcing a broad smile to his face. "But a friendly wizard, seeking shelter for the night. We mean no harm to any here, I promise you. And we will pay for shelter." Inside the one-roomed cabin was an elderly woman, 3 young children, and a younger woman in a bed by the fire. The man was in his early 20s, stockily built, with thick, dark, curly hair.
"What else can go wrong?"
he shrugged, dropping the knife to a rough-cut table.
"For what it is worth, you're welcome. But the beasts stay outside."
"Of course." Ruad helped Gwydion into the house, and the hounds sat outside the door, the rain streaming from their metal hides. Inside once more, Ruad removed his soaked leather jerkin and stood before the fire, enjoying the warmth. The children sat quietly staring at him, their eyes wide and fearful, while the old woman returned to the bedside, where she sat dabbing at the brow of the younger woman.
"Is she sick?"
Gwydion asked. The young man looked away and sat at the table, staring at the wall. Gwydion struggled out of his white woolen robes and laid them over a chair by the fire. Dressed only in a loincloth, he dried himself by the blaze and then moved to the bedside. The young woman was skeletally thin, her skin almost translucent. Dark rings had formed beneath her eyes. When Gwydion lifted her wrist, the pulse was weak and fluttering like a trapped butterfly.
"May I take your seat?"
he asked the old woman.
"I am weary from my travels."
She looked up at him, her eyes dull, then stood and moved away, shepherding the children to their beds by the other wall. Gwydion placed his hand on the dying woman's brow, closing his eyes and seeking the colors. The red was still powerful, yet less so than in Macthar. He rose through it to the outer edges of the harmony, fastening to the green. Slowly he linked with the woman, flowing with her blood, pulsing with the rhythms of her life. He found the cancer. It had spread across both lungs and down into her stomach.
"Fetch me a piece of meat," he said.
The young man ignored him, but Ruad walked to the table and touched him on the shoulder.
"Bring some meat to my friend." "Dying people give him an appetite, do they?"
"It is not to eat. Do as I ask, please." The young man rose and fetched a joint of ham from a hook on the pantry, carrying it to Gwydion.
"Put it in a bowl on the bed," said the elderly healer.
The old woman fetched a bowl and the ham was placed in it. Ruad joined them. Gwydion soared into the colours. One bony hand rested on the woman's brow, the other on the meat in the wooden bowl. Gwydion's face grew ever more pale and he began to tremble. Ruad moved alongside him, waiting. The young woman groaned.
"What is he doing?"
the young man asked.
"Be silent,"
hissed Ruad. The old woman gasped and stepped back, her hand over her mouth. The meat in the bowl began to writhe and darken. White maggots appeared, and the stench of corruption filled the room as the ham grew slimy, edged with blue. Maggots crawled over the old man's fingers. The young woman's face seemed less translucent now, and her cheeks showed colour. Gwydion's hand slipped from her brow, and as he toppled, Ruad caught him and carried him to the fireside, where he laid him on the goatskin rug before the hearth.
"Get a blanket,"
ordered Ruad. The old woman brought two and covered the sleeping healer with one, making a pillow of the other, which she eased under his head.
"Amta,"
cried the young man as his wife's eyes opened.
"Priam,"
she whispered,
"I have been dreaming."
The young man's eyes filled with tears, and he leaned over the bed, taking Amta in his arms. Turning, the old woman began to weep. Ruad patted her shoulder and moved to the bedside.
"How are you feeling?"
he asked the woman.
"Tired, sir. Who are you?"
"Travelers, passing through. Sleep now. In the morning, you will feel better."
"I doubt that, sir. I am dying."
"No," Ruad told her. "Tomorrow you will wake and rise, and all will be as it once was. You are cured." The woman smiled, disbelieving, but faded into sleep as Brion lifted the blankets around her, then rose.
"Is it true?"
he asked, his face still wet with his tears.
"I do not lie.
Well, not often. Gwydion is a healer, a great healer."
"I have no way to repay you. I do not even own this cabin. Food is short. But what I have is yours."
Ruad grinned. "A roof for the night and perhaps a little breakfast. I am afraid the ham is ruined, and I should take it from the house before the stench reaches us all." The young man took the decomposed meat from the house and hurled it into the undergrowth. When he returned, he offered Ruad a goblet of water.
"We have no wine or ale,"
he apologized. "This will suffice."
"Are you truly men?"
asked Brion. "Yes, do we look so strange?"
"No, not at all, it's just, you're an answer to prayer, and it comes to me you may be gods."
"If I was a god," said Ruad, grinning, "but I've made myself so ugly."
Ruad lay beside the sleeping Gwydion on the floor by the fire, his thoughts sorrowful. Gwydion had cleansed the cancer from the woman, Amta, but to Ruad, the scene was only a grim reminder of the malignancy eating at the heart of the realm. And Ruad knew that he, as the armourer Olathaer, had helped that cancer to grow. Despite his wisdom, perhaps even because of it, he had fallen victim to the god of folly, pride. When the new king, Ahak, fresh from his triumph in the Fomorian Wars, sent word to Olathaer of the world beyond the gate, it had seemed the answer to prayer. All his life, Olathaer had sought to excel, first to impress his father, Caliban, and then to be the greatest armourer in the long history of the knights. He could still recall with total clarity the night the king's messenger brought in the letter. A visit had come to Ahak, claiming to be from the land called the Vairi. "This land was beset," said the messenger, "by great evil. They needed the legendary knights of the Gabala to come to their aid. In return, they offered gifts of medicine and knowledge that would eradicate sickness and disease, that would bring a new era of peace and contentment to the Gabalan people."
At first, Olifair had been skeptical. But the king sent a silver mirror imbued with a magic more powerful than anything Olifair had ever experienced. Using the mirror, he could focus on any part of the realm and see it clearly. More, he could pierce the mystic curtain between the worlds of the Gabala and the Vairi. And he found, as the messenger said, a land of great wonders, a white, many-towered city peopled by angelic beings, was surrounded by impenetrable forests in which dwelt creatures of nightmare. It was the jewel of paradise, set amidst the horrors of hell. Olifair made contact with a man named Paulus, a counselor of the Vairi elders. Paulus begged the armorer to send his knights, and Ahak also urged the armorer to respond. For Olifair, this was an opportunity his pride forbade him to ignore. He had the chance to outdo his father Caliban, and to earn his place in history as the greatest armorer. He had called Sameldenach to him, and the Lord Knight had questioned him until dawn. If hell surrounded the Vairi, how could they survive? How could they combat the screaming demons with their long talons? How could they return once Olifair was no longer with them? He answered all questions with promises. He would make finer armor. He would create swords that would never dull. He would reopen the gate between worlds at prearranged times, beginning 1 month after they had passed through, and he would stay in contact with them, using the magic mirror. Sameldenach was enchanted with the idea, and with the gifts promised by the Vairi. He longed to be the knight who brought an end to disease and despair. Olifair had opened the gate on Midsummer's Eve 6 years ago, and Sameldenach had led the knights through, never to return. Olifair had hurried back to the citadel and taken up the mirror, but only his reflection stared back at him. He tried the colors. Black under the moonlight, blue under the sun, red with his own blood, but the mirror had lost its power. Fear began to gnaw at him. And he tried in every way to breach the gate with his spirit, but it seemed that a wall, invisible and yet impenetrable, had been set before him. He contacted the king to see if the messenger was still at Firbolg, but the man had returned to his own land. Olifair was beside himself. All his powers were useless. He had one great hope. Sameldenach, greatest of warriors, finest of men, a descendant of kings and the most complete knight Olifair had ever known. Whatever perils lay beyond the gate, the armorer was sure Sameldenach would overcome them. The days drifted by with agonizing slowness until the month had passed, and Olifair cast the spell that opened the gate. Screeching creatures of nightmare gathered in the darkness beyond. But the armorer's powers hurled them back. Of the knights, there was no sign. Night after night, Olifair conjured the gate, until his powers were spent, his strength wasted. Finally, he had traveled to Firbolg. The king had greeted him like an old friend, and had entertained him royally for several weeks. But then he had been asked to create weapons of power for the monarch, and he had refused. As the armorer of the Gabala knights, he was not under Ahak's rule. The king had ordered him arrested, claiming his refusal bordered on treason. For days he had suffered torture. His eye burned from his skull, hot iron scorching his flesh. Then he had feigned death and been hurled into a shallow pit outside the city walls. He had escaped. But it was almost a year before his strength and power returned. Then he had taken the name Ruad Rofessa and moved to the north, and for 3 years had explored every means of breaching the world beyond. At last, he was forced to the inescapable conclusion that the knights, his knights, had been slain. Sameldenach, Edrin, Peteus, Mananan, Bursis, Cantore, Joannin, Kariste, and Bodach, all dead. Ruad Rofessa carried the blame like a burning coal in his heart. Yet now, here on this wooden floor, the pain was worse than ever before. For the king had embarked on a reign of terror and had gathered to him other knights, dread warriors strengthened by sorcery. And the world needed the true knights more than ever. At last, Ruad fell asleep. But his dreams were of fire and blood, and knights in crimson armor hunted him with knives of cold steel. He awoke sweating in the pre-light of dawn. Gwydion slept on, as did the household. He sat up and added tinder to the ashes, stirring them and blowing the flickering embers to life. Brion awoke and stared down at his sleeping wife. He kissed her lightly and her eyes opened.
"It was true," she whispered. "I am healed."
Umta sat up.
"There is no pain."
"When I woke, I thought it was a dream," Brion said, cupping her face in his hands.
Ruad grinned and rose from the floor.
"Good morning to you both. You slept well, I trust?"
"Yes, sir,"
said Brion, sliding from beneath his blanket and standing.
"I promised you breakfast, and you shall have it. Eggs, bacon, and I shall borrow ale from Dalek."
A low metallic growling came from outside, and Ruad ran to the door and opened it. A small crowd had gathered silently to examine the hounds, and one man had tried to prise a golden scale loose. As Ruad appeared, the crowd fell back. Brion ran from the house and swiftly explained the presence of his visitors and the magic they had wrought. Within an hour, the news had spread to settlements nearby, and a larger crowd had gathered, many of them sick or with boils or deep cuts or swollen joints. Ruad woke Gwydion.
"You had best eat, my friend. I fear you have a busy day ahead."
For most of the morning, Gwydion plied his trade on the porch of the cabin, receiving payment in copper and silver coin, goods, a battered knife and two hatchets, three blankets, a small sack of flour, a side of ham, a barrel of ale, a pair of boots, a cloak, two chickens, seven pigeons, and a silver ring set with a black stone. And occasionally just the promise of food and a bed for the night, should he desire it. By noon the old man was exhausted, and he sent away the 15 or so who were still waiting, promising to see them tomorrow. He gave the chickens and the ham to Brion, and then Ruad, he and the family enjoyed the small barrel of ale.
"Had I known my powers would be so great here, I would have come 5 years ago," said Gwydion. "The green is easy to find and very strong."
At dusk, a rider came to the settlement. People hid behind locked doors, watching the man from behind barred shutters as he reined in his stallion before the house that boasted the three golden hounds.
"Ollifer," he called, "come forth."
Ruad opened the door and stepped into sight. The man looked familiar, but his face was hard to see, for he wore a helm, and though the visor was up, the sun was behind him.
"Who calls for Ollifer?"
Ruad asked. The man dismounted.
"One who knows him well,"
said the rider, approaching the armourer. All colour fled from Ruad's face as he recognised the workmanship of the battered helm and the grey eyes of the once knight.
"Mananon," he whispered. "It cannot be."
"It is Mananon," said the once knight. "It is the traitor, Mananon. I have no right to ask this of you, but it would be pleasant if you would remove this damned helm. I fear the beard within the neck plates is strangling me to death. I have worn it for 6 years.
"How did you get back?"
"I never went. As Samildanach beckoned us forward, something inside me snapped. Fear swept through me like a storm, and I turned my horse away into the shadows."
Despair struck Ruad anew.
"Then you do not know what became of them?"
"No. Will you help me?"
"I cannot, Mananon. If I could, I would do it in an instant.
that the spell I cast was to protect you in the inferno beyond the gate, and the gate is the key. All spell locks were made to be undone the moment you passed back through the gate.